Tell Bob I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Hi. I'm real glad to be here. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Pat. Thank you, Pat, for asking me. If I don't know anything else as I've come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell you that if it wasn't for the people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at 9:15 on a Saturday night, I'd be loaded right now. Right this minute. Next to anybody here wouldn't be loaded at 9:15 on a Saturday night. You don't belong. You're any good alcoholic to be loaded at 9:15 on a Saturday night. I'd be at the 49ers or someplace, you know. Because I love to drink and I love to get loaded. I loved it. It was my favorite thing to do. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and hear people talk about remembering their first drink. And I'm married to a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she vividly remembers taking her first drink at 12 and, you know, things happening, fears leaving. And I don't remember my first drink. I come from an Irish Catholic alcoholic family, and it was always there, and I always used it. And before I go any further, I'd like to say that I don't blame the fact that I'm an alcoholic coming from an Irish Catholic alcoholic family. It's sometimes in AA that seems like it's required, but I don't think that has anything to do with me being in AA. For years, I blamed my conduct on my heritage, that I was a drunk because I come from a family of drunks and American because I'm German. I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think I'm a product of my own self, that I would have been what I am no matter what. And that's only after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and seeing an awful lot of people here that are here, and they come from non-Catholic, non-Irish, non-alcoholic families, and they're here too. And the first time that I ever drank or got drunk, I don't think I remember it, but I was 3 or 4 years old, and it was just my mother and I. My father got killed in the Second World War, and my mother was going to go drink with her girlfriends, and she couldn't get a babysitter and decided to take me along, and took me along, and I was toddling around the bar, and the guys in the bar thought it'd be fun to get the little kid drunk, and they got me drunk, and I just, you know, staggered and fell down and puked like little drunks do. I mean, you know, I mean, in fact, not much changed the next 30 years of my drinking. My last drunk, I just staggered and puked and fell down a lot. You know, not a hell of a lot of changes. And I don't think I remember 3 years old, but it was talked around the family and laughed and kidded about. And booze was always around there, and it was just no big deal. And the drunks all over my family. In fact, my favorite relatives were the biggest drunks of the family. They're the most fun people. My very favorite aunt that died of alcoholism, my Aunt Rose, and I loved her dearly. In fact, I like drunks. I still like drunks. I like wet drunks and I like sober drunks. I don't like people that don't drink. I don't. I'm talking about those other people. They're just dull. You know, they're too good. And I don't like people that are real good. And I've been sober long enough to know you guys aren't real good. But I like drunks, and my favorite aunt and uncle were the biggest drunks of them all, and booze didn't seem to be any kind of a problem in our house. My mother drank a lot, and I don't know whether she's an alcoholic or not. She's dead a long time. It doesn't make any difference. And it didn't seem to be that much of a problem until I was about 10 years old, and my mother remarried, and she married a full-blown alcoholic, and that's when the war broke out in our house and became a full alcoholic household, and it was bad news. It was just bad news. This guy was a bad drunk, and bad enough if he was drinking alone, but him and my mother together, it was just unbelievable. I heard an Alateen talk one time, and he was talking about the silence in an alcoholic household, and I know what the kid was talking about. I can remember being at home, and I'd be in bed, and I'd hear him come home from the bar, and it's quiet, and I'm just laying there, and my heart's beating, and I know it's going to start any minute. It's just going to start. They'd be in the kitchen drinking, and they'd start drinking, and it'd get a little louder, and the talk would get a little louder, and rumbling, and then the screaming and hollering, and then smack and bang, and glasses breaking, and chairs shuffling around, and my stepfather would be beating the hell out of my mother, and I'd go down there to defend her, and he'd beat the hell out of me, and it was just insane. And I remember one time he was out on a drunk by himself, and my mother and I are just sitting there watching TV, and we hear him coming, and we know it's going to be trouble, and she said, just ignore him. And he came in, and we're just sitting watching television, and we're just trying to ignore him, and he's trying to start a fight, and we're just watching the television set. And he goes down to the cellar, and he gets a sledgehammer, and he puts it through the front of the television set, and boom, the goddamn thing explodes. It was just absolutely insane, you know. And through all of that conduct and all that stuff that was going on in my house, I never remember thinking I won't drink. I never honestly remember thinking, I'm not going to get married. That seemed to be the problem. She married that son of a bitch, you know. Everything was okay till he came along. And I started going out and getting drunk at every opportunity when I was about 15 years old. And I went out and got drunk at every opportunity from the time I was 15 years old till I was 32 years old and came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not going to stand here and tell you that it was a rotten 17 years of drinking. I had a great time for a long time. I come to AA meetings sometimes, I'll hear people talking at the podium, they do a 40-year litany of terror. It was miserable, never had any fun, and it was just and I feel sorry for them. I had a great time. The last 3 or 4 years wasn't too slick, and that's why I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. If it was still good, I'd still be doing it. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was convinced that I'm just a juicer. A lot of my friends in AA are dope fiends and heroin addicts and stuff like that, and I'm just a boozer. And after I got here and got a little bit honest, I love speed. But taking bennies isn't taking dope. I mean, come on, that's just... So an alky, man, that's maintenance, you know. I love bennies. I was telling Cheryl, every time I run to San Diego, I think of runs I made to TJ and Ensenada. We used to buy them by the jar, you know. I took bennies when they were those big white crosses. Then they came out of little mini bennies, didn't seem to be as good. And they just make you real aware. I mean, you know, you could see a dime on the floor and say, 1942D. Boom, I mean, you know, you can see stuff, you know. And I love it. I just love it. I'm a hyper guy anyway, man. And eating those bennies and speeding. And if I'm going on a 4-day drunk, I don't want to miss a lick. You know, and I didn't miss much. And I was a barroom drinker. I loved the bars. I loved the people in the bars. I loved the music in the bars. My wife that I'm married to, she spent a lot of her time sitting in a black beanbag chair with a bottle of Jack Daniels, and that ain't my style of drinking. I'm out amongst them. I love bars. There's a tremendous fellowship in those bars. You know, I don't care what kind of a jackpot you get yourself into. Those folks understand. They'll validate your ticket. They're living the same kind of life. They got to validate your ticket, you know. First time I got arrested with it was in 1962 in Long Beach. I live in Long Beach, and I wasn't then. And I got arrested for drunk driving, and while I was in jail, the Long Beach cops beat me up, and I was in there about 3 days. I get out, I'm in the bar drinking. I told a guy about it. I said, I was in jail in Long Beach, and I said, the cops beat me up. He said, don't drink in Long Beach. They got bad cops down there, you know. He understood. But then later I got arrested in Linwood and I got beat up. I got arrested in Southgate and I got beat up. I got arrested in L.A. and I got beat up. Every time I got arrested, I got beat up. Because I just didn't know how to keep my mouth shut. I always felt like they were taking my rights away or something, you know. And I'm just a cocky little bastard. I just didn't know how to shut up, you know. I'd always seem to get in a fight with them about towing my car away. I always thought the cops and tow truck drivers were in cahoots, you know. I still think the top cops and tow truck drivers are in cahoots. It's a scam. I was talking at a meeting in Santa Monica a couple months ago, and as I was speaking, they're towing my car away. The fact that I parked under a no parking tow away sign should have had nothing to do with it, you know. They say I love drunks, and I watch drunks. If I'm out on the freeway and I see a drunk and hitting those little buttons, bip, 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 you know, trying to make it down the road, and I like to get up alongside them and look at them. You know, see how they're doing, you know, they're nodding off or they're up real close and, you know, I just want to see how they're doing. And about a year ago, I had to go to, more than that, I guess, I don't know. Well, back, I had to go to Miami on a sales trip and I flew out of Long Beach. I went from Long Beach to Dallas to Miami and the second half of that flight, the plane lightened up in Dallas and I was sitting on the aisle and there was nobody in the middle and there was a lady sitting out the window. And they're serving, and they sort of said, well, you know, I said, a cup of coffee. And she asked the lady, she said, would you like a drink, ma'am? And she said, sure. She said, I'd like a rum and Coke. She said, but could I have the whole can of Coke? And the steward said, sure, no problem. So she brings the drinks, and I'm fixing my coffee, you know, I'm watching her fix her drink. That lady took that little bottle of rum. She made 4 goddamn drinks out of it. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. She got that little bottle, and she goes, drip, 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 and then fill it up with Coke, you know, and drink it, you know. And I'm fixing my coffee, and I'm watching her, and I'm thinking, drink the goddamn thing, for Christ's sake. Stop screwing around with it, you know. I mean, that makes me nuts, you know. Flip side of that, I was in Hawaii in November for the Hawaii convention. I went there for the convention and a vacation. And there were a bunch of drunks, and we went out to dinner. I went to Benihana of Tokyo, you know, and they're nice and fun to go to. And they say he had a grill, like. And the chef, you know, he does tricks and stuff like that. And there was 6 of us, and they seat about 8 people at that. So there were 6 drunks, and they set this other couple down on the end here. You know, you introduce yourself, hi, how are you, and everything. And we're visiting, and they come for the drink order, and we're ordering coffee and Coke and whatever. And this very nice couple, middle-aged couple, they're from Portland, Oregon. And very nice, pretty lady and man. And says the guy, what do you want? He said, double scotch and rocks, appropriate. And this very nice school teacher looking lady, she says, I'm a double Smirnoff straight off, nothing back. I said, all right. So I'm watching the lady, she can bring her in a little water glass, double scotch, or double Smirnoff. So I'm watching. I'm drinking my coffee. I'm watching her drink this thing. And maybe she'd take a little sip and talk and everything. And it comes and she's talking with her husband. And she goes, whoom. Right down, you know. So I'm still watching. And she's talking to her husband. And she goes. I said, it hit. All right. She had four of them. I like this lady, you know. But I like drunks. I just like drunks. Drunks are interesting, most fun people that I know. Sober drunks or wet drunks. I get dabbling and forget to get sober, so I better start getting sober. The last job that I lost was in 1974. August of 74, I don't remember what day. It was the same day that Nixon got candored by. We got it the same day, Nixon and I, you know. He's going on the airplane and I'm out the door. And rather than go get another job, this drinking friend and I decided we'd start our own company. And I'd been working as a manufacturer's representative salesman in the consumer electronics business. And he and I printed up some cards and got some lines to sell and worked out of his house in the valley. And Tom and I were drinking friends, and we'd go out and make sales calls together in the morning. And if we made a sale, we'd stop in a bar and have a couple of drinks and celebrate. And we didn't make a sale, we'd stop in the bar and have a couple of drinks and bitch about it, you know. And in spite of that conduct, we eked out some kind of a living. And Thanksgiving 1974 rolled around. And in my business at that time, not so much today, you pretty much had to have all your Christmas business taken care of, or you couldn't get it shipped in time for Christmas. And our business was taken care of as much as it could be for the holidays. And I started on a drunk the day before Thanksgiving, 1974, to carry me through the end of the year. And I've got to tell you that I wasn't drunk every single day from the Wednesday before that Thanksgiving through the end of the year. Because the end of my drink, I couldn't drink every day. I couldn't. My early days of drinking, I could drink every day, and I'd get drunk occasionally. At the end of my drinking, I just couldn't drink every day. What was happening to me about 4 or 5 years before I got the program Alcoholics Anonymous is, it says it in chapter 3, we lose the ability to control and enjoy our drinking. And that's exactly the sequence that left me. I lost the ability to control, and then the enjoyment went. I was getting drunk by accident. Did you ever get drunk by accident? You know, I didn't plan on getting drunk. I planned lots of drunks. What was happening to be, it'd be the middle of the week, and it'd be a Tuesday, and I always worked, so I was getting worse and worse hangovers, and hangovers are getting too hard to shake and too hard to work with them. So it'd be the middle of the week, and I think, okay, I'm just going to go in this beer bar. Every time I drink that whiskey, I get in trouble. So I'm going to go in a beer bar, shoot a couple games of pool, and visit with the guys and go home. And I'd go in there and have a couple beers, and before I know it, they're flashing the lights on, it's 2 o'clock, and they're throwing me out, and I think, God damn it, I didn't want to get drunk tonight, man. I got to work tomorrow. And I was getting drunk when I didn't want to get drunk. So I turned myself into a weekend drunk years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And just going to drink on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. And I quickly turned it into Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Get early start on the weekend Thursday night. And, so the last 4 or 5 years of my drinking, I was basically drunk Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm getting well for the next Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And that's how this drunk went through this holiday season. I'd be drunk for 4 days and getting well for 3 days, and drunk for 4 days and getting well for 3 days. And there's days that I got up and I just couldn't drink. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about drinking a couple of quarts a day right up to the bitter end, and I admire them. God, I tried hard and I couldn't. I just couldn't. I'm sorry. I tried. I can remember a lot of times getting up sick and trying to get a drink down just to get well, and I just couldn't. I'd take a shot of whiskey, it'd stop right in my throat. My throat would close up, and I'd have to spit it out. Try again, spit it out. And I just couldn't get it down. I tried to get a beer down, it was like drinking molasses, just thick and heavy. And I know I just have to sit this one out. I just sit and shake it off. And then I'd get physically well a little bit, and I'd start the whole routine all over again. And Christmas came that year, and I had been married, and it was talked about, you were talking about, and I like it heard a lot, and it's read in chapter 5, are you willing to go to any length to get sober? That's something that's said at every meeting, and it's a key word. And I remember the first time that really sunk in. That's a heavy-duty statement. Are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? Because I can tell you, I was willing to go to any length to protect my right to drink. Any length to protect my right to drink. I'd been married and had a couple of kids, and I put that wife through every kind of hell you can put somebody through, physical and emotional. In fact, the person I hated the worst in the world was my stepfather. Hated him with a passion. And I became everything that he was and then some. Everything he ever did to my mother, I did to my wife. Everything he ever did to me, I did to my kids, and then some. And that wasn't something I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and found out through an inventory. I knew that. I knew that long before. I knew a lot of truth before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew. And it kept me drunk, for I knew how I really was. I didn't come here and discover that stuff. I knew. And that girl, I put her through everything you can put somebody through. And talking about going to any length, she came to me one time and she didn't even ask me to quit drinking. It sounded to me like she said it, but the way she said, Ray, she said, I can't live like this anymore. She said, it seems like you're drunk all the time. You're drunk all the time, and I just can't live like this anymore. And if you don't do something, I'm going to have to leave. And what I heard her saying, you got to quit drinking and stop hanging out with those bums you hang out with, or I'm leaving with the kids. And it seemed to me my choice was my right to drink and my two kids, and my drinking friends are my wife and two kids. And I told her to pack it. Take off. Nobody tells me when and where to drink. Who the hell do you think you are? I pay my own way. And I was willing to give my wife and two kids up. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard people talking in the podium about what got them to Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything I've ever heard happened to me long before I ever got here. Long before I ever got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear people say about they were going to lose their wife, or did lose their wife, or got a 502, or wrecked a car, or lost a job, or, you know, whatever. And that happened long, long, long before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. None of that stuff was going to get me sober. Nothing was going to get me sober. You know. And she finally did leave. And that never did get back together, and that's okay. That was all right. In fact, she left. I remember I came home that day and renting a house in Huntington Park. And I pulled in the driveway and I knew something looked funny. You know, there's usually a tricycle in the driveway or something. Just didn't look right. It was too clean. And I walk in the house and, man, she cleaned that sucker out. It was empty, you know. Hardwood floor. The carpet was up off the floor. And then she's walking through and it's echoing. And I walk in and she left one dish and one fry pan and one knife and one fork and one cup and one little cereal bowl. And then I went in the bedroom. She left the sleeping bag and the old black and white TV. And, man, I was hot. I was hot. Yeah, I'm going to tell you why I was hot. I wasn't hot because she took all the furniture. I was hot because the day before was payday and she had the paycheck. I'd kill her for that paycheck. She can have this furniture and stuff. I need money. I need money to operate. You know. You know, it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that alcoholics react to life differently than normal folks. And I reacted to life differently than normal folks, and I still react to life differently than normal folks. I wasn't reacting to that situation normally at all. So she did leave, and we never did get back together. And from living with me, she went through a lot of hell and had a lot of problems. And she wasn't particularly a boozer, but she was starting to have a lot of like neck problems and back problems and head problems and going to psychiatrists and neurologists and lots of stuff. And she was having these problems, real or imagined, I don't know, but it ended up that she was going to a dozen different doctors, had a dozen different scripts going all over town, and she was just loaded on prescription drugs all the time. And one day her mother called me, and she said, Penny's in the hospital. And I didn't say it, but I thought, so what? She's in the hospital a lot, it seems, and I just didn't care. And she said, no, she's real bad. You better come over here. And I'll tell you about that because it'll give you a real accurate picture of what kind of guy Ray really is, and I don't want to leave you here with any false impressions. Her mother and I go over to the hospital, and she's in there in intensive care, and she's on life support systems, and we're visiting, and the doctor came in, and he said, that's as good as she's going to get. You know, what do you want us to do? And we talked a little bit, and he said, you can't do anything, and he said, no, that's it. And I am capsuling it all down, of course, but we finally said, well, then just pull the plug. And they pulled the plug, and she died at 26 years old from a drug overdose that caused a cerebral hemorrhage. And when... I'm going to tell you what happened right after that, because that will tell you the whole story about Ray. We go into the waiting room for them to do whatever they have to do, and we're in there visiting and stuff, and the nurse comes in to see us, and the nurse comes in, she's crying, and she tells us she's dead, and my mother-in-law started crying. I didn't cry. I learned to cry in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm forever grateful for that. But you know what my first reaction to that situation was? He told us that. I said, God damn it, I'm stuck with those kids. There's something wrong with that. Something wrong with that. There's something wrong with someone that thinks like that. No care or compassion for this girl. Nothing. Me. You know, it says in the book, selfishness and self-centered is the root of our problem. All I can think about is me. Me, 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 me. How does it affect me? What about me? And I'm having that thought, and I'm having it, but I don't want to have it, but I do want to have it. You know what I mean? It's one of those 49-51 deals. Man, I know it's wrong to be thinking like that, but it's what I want. And I know I'm a drunk, for Christ's sakes. I know I'm a drunk, but there's something rotten about me. I'm just rotten. And I know it. Because I know normal people don't think like that. They just don't. There's something sick about that. And I know it. And we leave there and we get in the elevator and my mother-in-law says, I'll take care of the kids, Rick. She knows I'm real sick and can't take care of them. And I just go, phew, all right. So this Christmas comes 1974. My kids are living with their grandmother over in Linwood. And I live in the town of Southgate. And it's just side-by-side towns. And I got Christmas presents in the trunk of my car to take over to my kids. And I'm going to tell you what got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't going to jail. I wasn't getting beat up by the cops. It wasn't bar fights or losing that wife and kids or losing the job or wrecking the cars or any of that. Might be perceived by some people to be just nickel and dime stuff. What got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is Christmas coming and trying to make it over to see my kids and not being able to make it over there. Having visitation rights with my kids on the weekend and not showing up at all to pick them up and Monday morning calling them one more time and laying a story on them. Sick and hungover Monday morning and calling my kids and getting ready to lay a story on them. But my kids can sense it and they let me off easy. I go to lay a story on my son and he'd say, oh, Dad, that's okay. You had to work, huh? Yeah, I had to work. I didn't have to make up a story. Kind of give me one, you know? And promising that next weekend I'll come early on Friday and pick you up. We spend the whole weekend together, I promise you. And get my daughter on the phone, and she was real small then. And promise her one more time that I'll come and pick them up. And next weekend I'd roll around and I'd stop to have a drink and I ain't making it. And now I'm supposed to bring Christmas presents over and I can't make it across town to bring him Christmas presents. Every time I compromise myself with that, and every time I told one of those little horseshit lies, people talk about getting in and having a big hole blowing through them, and I understand I had a big hole blowing through me. Every time I told one of those lies, it just tore a hunk of whatever's decent in me as a human being, as a man, just ripped it out and threw it away. And it was ripped out in hunks. Nickel and dime stuff. Nickel and dime lies. Nickel and dime compromise. The big stuff is no sweat. It's the nickel and dime stuff. You know, nickel and dime thoughts, nickel and dime lies, nickel and dime actions. That's what got me sober and programmed alcoholics. Got me to program Alcoholics Anonymous. My kids don't, I don't make it over there at Christmas time, and I can't. This is too much. I can't go on like this. And New Year's Eve rolls around 1974, and I made a New Year's resolution. I quit drinking. That's it. I can't go on anymore. I'm not having any fun. It hasn't been fun for a long time. The hangovers are tougher and tougher. I'm depressed. I have these unbelievable depressions. Unbelievable depressions. And I'm not normally a depressed guy. I'm kind of up and laughing and scratching and giggling all the time. And I'm having these unbelievable depressions that I just couldn't shake. I can remember being hungover and coming home and I worked all day and this depression, this black gloom over me. And I'm watching I remember I was watching Walter Cronkite on the news. And he's smiling and I thought, what are you smiling about, asshole? Just unbelievable. It just had me all pulled down And I made a New Year's resolution. I quit. I just can't go on like this. And I quit drinking. New Year's Eve, 1974, I quit. The first week in January, 6th or 7th of January, my partner and I had to go to Chicago to a trade show. We hadn't seen much of each other that week. And I met him at LAX. We checked our bags. He said, let's go have a drink, Ray. And I said, I quit drinking, Tom. And he'd known me a long time. And he'd seen me quit drinking. And he said, oh, come on. I said, no, I made a New Year's resolution. I quit. And I haven't had anything since New Year's. I quit a lot. I mean, I quit a lot. At least once a week I quit. You know, I just couldn't stay quit. And he said, oh, come on. He said, come in the bar with me. So I go in the bar and he has a double scotch and I have a tomato juice and we visit and talk about the business we're going to conduct. We get there and we go back to get our boarding passes and the flight we're on is oversold. And they take us in the first class and I'd never flown in first class before and haven't since, now that I think about it. But, and they put us in first class. It's real nice. The big white seats and service is good and everything. And take off and he starts serving. And Tom said, hey, man, he said, all the drinks are free. And I don't know about you, but quitting drinking and quitting free ones is two different deals altogether. You know? It just don't count. It don't, you know. I remember that like it was yesterday. They came serving and I'm a smart guy. I'm not a bozo. I mean, I'm good at figuring stuff out. I'm a good figure outer. Some of the biggest jackpots I get in sobriety is because I'm figuring stuff out, you know. But I ordered a B&B liqueur. I don't drink B&B liqueur. But to me, I had it figured out. B&B liqueur don't count. You know, I had this whole thing figured in my head. It made sense. B&B liqueur don't count. You know, beer don't count. I've been drunk on beer lots of times, but it don't count. You know, any of the rum drinks with fruit punch and the flowers and umbrellas in them don't count. They're just foo-foo drinks, you know. Whiskey counts. Whiskey counts. And I started on these B&B liqueurs, and I was off and running. My last drunk was a four-day drunk. I have been sober, by the way, in Alcoholics Anonymous for 4,312 days. Yeah. I count my days, because they're important. Paul knows how many days he has. John knows how many days he has. I know how many days I have. It's important to me. It's important to those guys. It's important to me. So you have to sit there dividing 365 into 4,312. My sobriety date is April the 14th of 1975. I stay sober a couple months, I'll have 12 years of sobriety. That's an absolute miracle. Absolute miracle. Because I didn't come here to get sober for 4,312 days, honest. I really didn't. I'll tell you why I count my days. Count my days for... I started two reasons. Number one, and I was real new in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, you ask any newcomer how many days they got, they know. It's important. It's so important to me. See, if I don't count my days, I will take my sobriety for granted. This is only my deal. This is just my deal. And if I take my sobriety for granted, I'll lose it. Because anything I take for granted, I'll lose. I started counting my days in the beginning because one of the things they suggested I should do was pray and meditate, and I didn't know how to do that. Given up on the church a long time ago, and I was at my home group meeting, and I was looking at the literature table. I was about 2 weeks over, and there was a 24-hour day book there, a little black book. I'm flipping through it, and there's a thought for the day, meditation for the day, and a prayer for the day. And I thought, I'll read this every day, and that'll qualify me for my praying and meditating. A lot of God stuff in there, but I don't have to believe it. I'll just read it. And I bought that book that night, and I took it home, and I flipped it back to April the 14th, and I wrote First Day Sober. And I wrote a 2 and a 3 and a 4, and I brought it up to date. And I still have that same book, and I read it this morning, and the numbers go across the top and down the side. And I wrote down 4,312 days. And like I said, it keeps me aware of my sobriety. Aware of my physical sobriety. I was aware when I wrote down 4,312 this morning that it was a Saturday morning, and I was sober, and I wasn't hungover, and I had plans for the day. I knew I was coming here tonight, and some friends were going to come with me, and I knew what was happening, and I knew what I did the night before. And I'm sober on a Saturday morning. And it keeps me aware of that. I see people come to AA all the time. They're here a couple of years and start acting like they're supposed to be sober. Maybe they are. I ain't supposed to be sober on a Saturday night. I ain't supposed to be sober. And I am. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's why I continue counting my days. Keeps me aware of it. Anyway, my last drunk was a four-day drunk like they had been for a long time. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'll tell you something that might sound strange. I don't know. My last drunk wasn't the worst drunk I've ever had. I pray to God it's my last drunk. Wasn't the worst drunk I've ever had. I had many, many drunken weekends that should have gotten any sane person into thinking about doing something about their drinking that it never even dawned on me. I was just drunk for 4 days. I didn't go to jail. I didn't wreck any cars. I didn't spend an excessive amount of money. Didn't get any fights. Nothing. Just drunk. Drank till 4 o'clock in the morning, Saturday night, Sunday morning. Passed out for a couple hours, opened up an Amvets club in North Long Beach at 6 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, and you're on those drunks, you get up and you're about half in the bag, a couple of drinks, you're really in the bag, and about halfway through that morning, you ever drink yourself sober? You know how you drink, and you just kind of hit that little funny second wind of sobriety, and then you go for the, you know, and I'm on my second drug for the day, and I ended up in this upholstered sewer of a bar that I used to drink in Southgate, and all I can tell you is that, and this is all in retrospect, as the big book talks about, I had a moment of clarity. I could just see me for what I was and what I had been. And that this is as good as it's going to get. You know, this is as good as it's going to get. That the best I could look forward to next weekend is just another drunken 4 days. And the booze had quit working for me. And I want to explain that for anybody that's new. Because when I was new and people said the booze quit working, I was confused. I perceived, and maybe it was that way for some people, that they drank, and didn't get drunk. Well, I got to tell you, every time I drank, I got drunk. Every time I drank, I got drunk. It worked that way every single time. Right up to the end. The way it quit working for me is it quit working up here. I'd be drunk on the outside and sober on the inside. I remember coming home from a bar one night, and I walked to the bar because I was getting lots of 502s, and I just lived down the street. And I'm walking home, and I fell down on this guy's lawn, and I guess I made some kind of a commotion. It was late at night, and the guy comes out, and he has his bedclothes on and stuff, and he has a flashlight. And I'm laying on the ground, and I'm totally incapacitated drunk, just out of it. And he shines the flashlight down, and he hollers at his wife's door. He said, call the cops. There's some goddamn drunk out here. And I'm looking up, and I can't respond, but I can see him crystal clear. And I can hear him crystal clear. I know exactly what he's saying and exactly what he's doing. And I interpreted that to be insanity. You know, I make myself available for 12-step calls, and I hope you do too. And I have gone on 12-step calls, and I have seen drunks. And I can look in their eyes, and I know when they can see crystal clear, and they hear, they look like they're out of it, but they can hear and see me. And I know how they feel. Another, you look in their eye, you know they're out to lunch. Hey, out to lunch is good. If I could have stayed out to lunch, I'd still be drinking, for Christ's sake, you know. And I could see and hear crystal clear, and that's what's how it quit working for me. I always got drunk, but it didn't take it away. It was all sober inside. And I thought I was crazy, and I thought I should go to Nut House. And I was terrified to go to Nut House, absolutely terrified. I had this thing about if I got put in the Nut House, Norwalk State Hospital, I'd get in there, and somehow I'd get well, but nobody would believe I was well. And I'd be stuck in there, and I'd, you know, say, Doctor, I'm okay. And he'd say, yeah, make another wallet, pal, sit down. And I'd be just stuck in there with all these nuts. And that'd make me nuts, and I was just terrified of going to the Nut House. And as an alternate, I remembered a friend of mine I had run into at a cocktail party about 9 months before at Universal Studios, at the Sheraton Universal. And he's a guy that's in my business, and we drank together and known each other for a long time, and I hadn't seen him in a year or so, and he had been out of the business for a while, and I'm in a big ballroom at the Universal Sheraton, and I see him across the ballroom, and I go running across to visit with him, and he looks good, and I, hi, Chuck, how you doing, and everything, we're visiting, and he's standing there, he's drinking a Coke. It's a plain Coke. I finally said it. I said, what are you drinking? He said, Coke. I said, plain Coke? He said, yeah, Ray, I don't drink anymore. I said, you're kidding. Nothing? I mean, not drinking is just the beer once in a while. I'm not drinking, for crying out loud, you know. He said, no. I said, God damn. I said, how'd you do it, Chuck? He said, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, God mighty. I mean, I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anybody in AA. My perception of Alcoholics Anonymous is Skid Row, you know. I never saw the Days of Wine and Roses. I don't know. I'm looking at him. He looks pretty good. And I thought, for a guy who's been to Skid Row and back, he looks great. You know. He's all dressed real nice. I said, Chuck, how do you know you're an alcoholic? He said, why? Do you think you're one? I said, no. Wait a minute, you know. And I wanted to talk about Chuck, and he seemed to want to talk about me. He said, Ray, did you stop on the way home and have a drink fairly regularly? I said, yeah, fairly regularly. He said, why don't you try something? He said, on your way home, stop and have two drinks. Not one or four, two. And do that for about a month and see how it goes. Well, that was absolutely silly. I mean, I didn't even try it. I mean, it won't work. I know. I mean, I'm good at figuring stuff out. And I thought, okay, what if I stop and I have my two drinks and what if somebody buys me a drink? What are you going to do? You going to walk out? Come on. Yeah. You can't. So it won't work. And I thought about Chuck that day, and I had another drink, and I went home and called him. I don't remember the phone conversation. I grab remembrances. I was on the phone 5 or 10 minutes, and he tells me I was on the phone about an hour and a half, and I remember asking how much it cost to join and just stuff like that, you know. And all I remember Chuck saying, it seemed like everything I'd say to him, he just kept saying, I understand, pal, I know how you feel. I understand, pal, I know how you feel. And I believed he understood and knew how I felt. And at the end of the phone conversation, I remember telling him that my business partner and I were putting a business deal together and that I would hope this was a secret phone conversation, that, you know, word wouldn't go out. I don't want the industry to find out that I might call and inquire about AA. And I remember what I said beyond that. I went and passed out, and I found out later he called many times that afternoon and night to take me to a meeting, and I wouldn't go. And the next day I went to work, and the day after that my partner and I went to visit with this guy we're going into business with. And our little two-man company is merging with a one-man company, our offices, and get more efficient and so on. And we're at this guy's office, and we're discussing this deal we're going to put together in the next couple of weeks. And my partner leaves to go to an appointment. I'm getting ready to walk out the door, and I'm still hungover from the weekend. And as I'm walking out, he said, hey, I understand you called Chuck Harper the other day. And I thought, God damn it, he called this guy, and he's going to blow this deal for me. And he could see me getting hot, and he started laughing. He said, Ray, he said, I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 27 years. This guy's sober in AA 27 years. Now, I got to tell you, if he was here right now and I told you he was sober, he looks like he sobered up 15 minutes ago. This guy looks like an alcoholic, you know. Yeah, most of you guys don't look like alcoholics, you know. Well, Pat looks like an alcoholic, but the rest of you guys look all right, you know. And I had known him about 7 years, and he's a big, tall guy, and I used to be at meetings and conventions with him, and he'd be telling jokes and slapping people on the back and all that. I always thought he was loaded. He's acting like he's loaded, you know. He's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 27 years. And he took me to my first meeting and became my first sponsor, and still is one of my sponsors today. And he's still sober today. And he took me to my first meeting, which is a big book group in Bellflower. It's a Monday night speaker meeting, and it's my home group and my friends from the big book group here with me. And it's a big speaker meeting, much format like your guys, except two 10-minute speakers in front instead of the participation. And I met him there, and I come in the door, and about a room about this size that goes off the side a little bit anyway, and I said, are all these people alcoholics? And he said, yeah, you know, there's a couple of guests in Alma, but most all of them, because none of them look like alcoholics except him, you know. And he took me over by the kitchen door, and he said, I want you to meet somebody. He says, this is Eddie, my sponsor, and this is Ray, it's his first meeting. And he's a guy I like to talk about because he was real important to me in my early sobriety, my early days and years of sobriety, and I like to talk about him because I don't want to forget him. He died about 7 or 8 years ago, and if you knew him, I don't want you to forget him. A fellow by the name of Eddie Regan. He was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a great guy, and he's a funny guy. Eddie, every time you talk to him, he'd get right up in your face, just right here, or talk right here. And he shook my hand, and he kind of pulled me. And when he did, he said, you an alcoholic? I said, I think so. He said, are you willing to go to any length to get sober? I said, I think so. He said, can you stay away from one drink for one day? I said, I think so. He says, sit down, you'll be all right. I thought, geez, what a weird old guy, man, you know. Is that the test? Did I pass the test, you know? And they started the meeting, and it sounded like a real neat deal. A real neat deal. Except for one thing. They talked about God. And I thought, oh, man, it's some religious deal or something. And if God has anything to do with getting sober, I ain't got a shot. I mean, he and I kissed off a long time ago. You know, I was raised in the Catholic. I used to be an altar boy. You know, a lot of ex-altar boys in AA. We could start alcoholic altar boy meetings and fill the rooms. You know, there's a gang of us, you know. I used to steal the wine and drink it. You know, and all the altar boys stole the wine. I know. I used to steal the communions and eat them. I don't go to church anymore, so I don't know what the deal is. I think it's changed. But when I was an altar boy and I went to church, you couldn't touch them and chew them or anything. And it was really... For a few non-Catholic, it's a little white wafer of bread, and it's the body of Christ is what it is. The nuns told us that. I believe them. That's right. It's the body of Christ. And I got my first communion, I remember, and they stuck in your tongue. I'm walking down the aisle and get stuck the roof of my mouth. I say, how do you get the body of Christ off the roof of your mouth? Because rolling with your tongue count as chewing, you know. I became an altar boy, and I stole them by the bagful, and I used to eat them and throw them all over the place. I'm sitting in this AA meeting, and they said God, and I thought, shit, man, it's Judgment Day. I've had it, you know. We ain't got... And then we stood up and said the Lord's Prayer, held hands, you know, I thought that was a little hokey. And they said the wrong Our Father. We didn't say it like that. We didn't say power and glory forever, amen. Why would the church be amen before that? You know, they're saying the Protestant Our Father. I said, oh, Christ. Raised in this Irish Catholic family, man, you don't trust people that don't drink and don't trust Protestants, you know. And here I am with a bunch of sober people, and they're saying the Protestant Our Father. And we left there and get in Mike's car to go to an Alfie's coffee shop. And Mike said, you got any questions? I said, yeah. I said, what about this God stuff? And he said, don't worry about it. Just don't worry about it. And that got me over the hump. I thought, okay, don't worry about it. And if you're new here and that bothers you, don't worry about it. It'll all come together. I assure you. And he said, what are you getting on the question? I said, what am I going to do at Christmas time, Mike? I remember I got sober in April. You know, I'm looking ahead. And Mike gave me the perfect answer. He said, Ray, don't worry about it. You might be drunk long before then. And I said, what? He said, what, any other questions? I said, yeah, what am I going to do with all my free time? Hey, if you're getting loaded all the time, right, and you ain't going to get loaded anymore, you're going to have all this free time and be bored. Boring, glum, and stupid, as the book says. It does say that in the book. And that's what I was worried about. And he said, Ray, you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and stay close to the people here. And he says, you won't be bored or have any free time. And I can guarantee if you're worried about that, my life is real full today. And they sat me in a coffee shop and presented me with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Mike and Eddie sat there and they gave it to me, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, exactly the way it was presented to them in 1948 when they got sober. And I tried by the best of my ability to pass it on to other people the same way. And I'll tell you what they told me. There's new people here. And if anybody tells you this is easy, they're lying to you. They're lying. Or they're smoking dope or something, man. They ain't sober. Because maintaining continuous sobriety for this alcoholic on a full-time basis with life on life's terms out there sometimes is real tough. Real tough. You know. But you can do it. And they said there's no free lunches. Eddie said, man, AA isn't a spectator sport. He said, you just don't come in here and sit your ass down and watch the game. You got to get active. And I have a job in my home group, and I've had a job since I got sober. I used to mop the floors and do different things. I was secretary, and I'm the chairman of my home group now. I put the chairs away after the meeting. It's a great job, you know. It's a good job, but really better than a secretary. And they said, if you want to stay sober, and along with being sober, be happy and comfortable. Sober all the time, happy and comfortable most of the time. You got to do some stuff. Said, you have to hang out with the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that meant kissing off all my old friends, and that was tough. Told me I have to have 10 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. I have a commitment to 3 meetings a week. I have a Monday, Wednesday, and a Friday commitment, and that along with my other AA commitments, I'm at 4 or 5 meetings a week, and that keeps me comfortable. Told me I have to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, this book right here. And I'm going to be honest with you, I'm not real good about that. I'm not real good about reading the book like I should. So on Wednesday nights, I go to a book study. We read it, discuss it, I learn stuff. Told me I have to work the steps that are in there. And I believe I really became a member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when out of enough pain of sobriety and a fear of getting drunk, I did a 4th and 5th step. The best description of a dry alcoholic is in the doctor's opinion. We are restless, irritable, and discontent. And I still become restless, irritable, and discontent. Still. That's not a drunk alcoholic, that's a sober alcoholic. Dry alcoholic. And I did a 4th and 5th step, and that's when I really became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, if you do those things, you'll find a God of your very own, and I have found a God of my very own. If I could wish you anything, I wish you sobriety, but I wish you a God like I have found. A God that just loves me. He never zings me or zaps me. He never hurts me. He doesn't test me to see how much I love him. Nothing annoys me more than going to a meeting and somebody said, well, I was driving home and my car got totaled by a truck. I guess it was God's will. Jeez, I feel like puking. You know, if I leave here tonight, we get in a wreck and the car gets totaled, God's going to say, hey, too bad, man. I hope your insurance premiums are paid up. That's a tough deal, Ray, you know. Yeah. My God don't wreck my car to test me to see how much I love him or kill off friends or relatives or any of that stuff. But God gets bad rap for a lot of stuff he ain't got nothing to do with. I just remember that postman a couple of months ago to kill those people in Oklahoma. I was listening to radio getting ready to go to a meeting one time and they're playing the excerpt from the services. And the priest says, well, God presents his will in strange ways sometimes. I said, man, they're bad rapping God for that thing. It was just some nutcase popping people, man. He's just a screwball. You know, my God loves me. And when I'm happy, he laughs with me. And when I cry, he cries with me. And God will do for me what I can't do for myself. And what I haven't been able to do for myself is keep myself sober for 4,312 days. And with God's help, I have. And Eddie said, if I did those things, I'd never have to get drunk again. And that's been true for me. I do these things because I never want to sober up again. Getting drunk still looks good. It does. I'm sorry. That goes away. It's beyond 12 years, I guess. Still looks good to the sick alcoholic head. I never, ever want to sober up again. And I promise you, if you do those things, you'll never have to sober up again either. And I want to thank you for having me, and I'll be back. Thank you.